this is Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today fled Iran with her mother and brother at the age of 8. Her family eventually found their way to a rundown hotel in Italy before being granted asylum in the US. She tells us about the migrant experience, how Taekwondo changed her life, and describes the people she met during the writing of her book, The Ungrateful Refugee. Dina Nayeri, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thank you for having me.
Your book, The Ungrateful Refugee, comes out of a Guardian long read piece, and I think it was one of the most widely shared long reads in the history of the Guardian. I mean, this has really captured people's imagination.
Yeah, no, that was quite surprising for me, and it was really nice to see people seem to care, you know, about the refugee experience. Although they did seem to care on both sides, so there was a lot of anger also.
Yeah. Well, this is very much based on your own experience. So your most recent book takes your own experience and weaves in and out of that and tells us about other stories that you found along the way. But let's concentrate on your life first, because you were born into really quite affluent surroundings in Iran in 1979. That, of course, was the year of the revolution.
Yes. My parents were doctors and they had their practices. My father was a dental surgeon and my mother was a physician. And, you know, we had a pretty comfortable life. And, you know, my family were Muslims, I guess, in name. They were secular Muslims. My father certainly was very secular and my mother was searching. And at one point, when I was 6 years old, my mother converted to Christianity and she started getting involved in the underground church in Isfahan, where we lived. And it was kind of very dramatic few years, right, as I started school, Islamic Republic school, which was also very strict and very religious. And of course, in those years also, the war with Iraq was going on. So, you know, every few weeks you were taping up your windows and running down into a shelter and, you know, wondering if you'd come back up to rubble. It's just so much was going on in those first 8 years of my life.
What made her convert?
Well, she was part of a very strict, very scholarly sort of family. Her father was incredibly strict, and her mother was actually a child bride. She married at 13 and had 4 children, I think, before she was 20, 21. So at one point, her mother escaped. She ran off to London, you know, with her youngest child. She raised her youngest child as British. She had the most incredible assimilation herself. But when I was 6 years old, my family were invited to go and watch that youngest child, an aunt, get married to a British man. There was all of this drama to try to go for a short time to London and see this wedding. And at this time, my mother converted. Now, the thing is, I think, you know, there's so many psychological explanations for this. She was part of a strict family. She was yearning for something. She wanted so much to please her mother. But, you know, if you ask her, she would also say she was searching for some kind of truth or her truth.
And her mother was Christian.
Yes. And her mother had converted to Christianity in London. Yeah.
You write in the book that, in fact, she was, as you say, searching, but that this, for her, was perhaps a form of feminism.
Yes, all my life I feel that I was searching for this doctrine of feminism, you know, this thing that I can truly believe in and has so many different layers that speak to the many complicated parts of my belief system. And I think my mom was searching for the same thing, but she couldn't go so far away from Islam as that. I think each generation perhaps just takes one or two steps. And so her one step toward that was to go from Islam in a country that required the hijab, in a country that gave women fewer rights, to say, you know, no, I'm going to be this rebel, this Christian. But at the same time, she wasn't rejecting God altogether and making, quote unquote, wild statements as I do about women's rights and things like that. So she took the one step, and I feel like then I was free to take a step even away from that and all religion.
You tell a wonderful story, just speaking about the hijab, of meeting one of your teachers who you'd only ever seen wearing the hijab. I'm so interested to hear that.
Yes, this story is fascinating because my memory turns it into a kind of magic. I had this first grade teacher that I adored. I was raised in a village with a lot of old women. You know, there were a lot of old grandmothers, and I thought of her as one of them. She was my Islamic, you know, Republic school required a certain dress code for the teachers. They were all fully, not in just a casual hijab, they were in long black chadors. So everything but her, the circle of her face was completely hidden. And, you know, I thought of her as an old lady and she was my favorite teacher. One day I came into my father's dental office. As I said, he was a dental surgeon and he was working on a woman in the chair. And my father's office, he's secular, so you didn't have to keep on your hijab. It's a private space. And this woman, you know, long long red hair draped over the chair, and I think she was wearing jeans. And my father said, "Dina, aren't you going to say hello?" And I thought, "Hello to who? To this stranger?" And she sat up, and it was my teacher, and she was young. She was, I think, in her 30s, and I was just flabbergasted. It was like somehow, you know, those fairy tales where the crone turns into the princess. I mean, it's a silly way to think about it, but I was so young. Mm. And then, of course, as she was leaving, she draped the chador back on again, and she lost all those decades again. And for a moment, I think I understood the purpose of mandatory hijab, you know?
That it kind of makes you invisible, almost.
Yeah, and I think it is very much about that when you force other people into that kind of religious dress. I think it suggests very different things when you've made the choice for yourself.
Mm-hmm. Your mother continued to get into trouble. I mean, there was no way that she could hand out religious tracts in the way that she was doing without attracting a great deal of negative attention.
I mean, she was handing out tracts to her patients. She was visiting a lot of communities of, you know, abused women, poor women. She was openly telling them about Christianity and thinking for themselves and that sort of thing. And she was even getting involved with underground radio stations and things like that. And yes, she got into trouble. She started to get arrested. And I believe she got arrested 3 times. And each time my father had to go and get her out. And they made demands and threats. They asked her to be a spy against the underground church. And she said no. And then the last time they said, "Well, next time we arrest you, if you say no again, then you'll be executed."
So you left.
So we left, yes. We escaped kind of in a very dramatic way. And, you know, this is all in the book, but the night that we left, there was another bomb scare and there were sirens and things were closed down. So it was scary.
And so while that was all going on, you took that opportunity to dive into a car and drive.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And we ran. And my father, he had friends everywhere. He had such deep roots in the community. And he was well-loved. And he wasn't an apostate, you know. So he called a friend in the airport who snuck us onto a cargo plane.
And you went to Dubai initially.
Well, yes. On that cargo plane, we only went to Tehran because you can't really get out of the country like that. But then we were in hiding as they tried to sort out some papers for us, as my father did. And then we went to Dubai. You know, we went on a very short visa that we planned to blow through. So very quickly thereafter, we became undocumented.
Mm-hmm. Ending up in Italy. Tell us about the Hotel Barbara, which is notorious. I mean, a lot of people know of it.
Yes. Well, Hotel Barbara was fascinating. It was a place where I learned a lot about human nature. This was a place, first of all, I should say that it was considered a low hardship camp, and I don't see it as that at all, but it was in the cusp of an old hotel on the top of a hill outside of Rome in a village called Mentana. And it was so intimidating driving up to it because it was this stately looking structure. But of course, it was all hollowed out and made into a refugee camp given to the government to house refugees. And so, you know, there were people from all over. There were people from Russia and Poland and Romania and Afghanistan and Iran and the kind of places, the countries that produced, you know, refugees in those days in 88 and 89. And it was only really used as a refugee camp for, I think, 2 years. And then it was abandoned for that. But during that time, I lived there. You know, after we were in Dubai, the UNHCR, it took them about 10 months to recognize us as refugees. And they're the ones who placed us there.
Mm-hmm. And living there, as you say, not low hardship at all. I mean, food difficult. You would save your lunches from the day and eat them the next day. I mean, yes. It sounds like a pretty extreme experience.
It was. I mean, it was certainly not as extreme as what you see in nowadays in Moria and Lesbos and in the islands in Greece. I mean, certainly that is a whole different level, but there were great difficulties because there were needs that were overlooked as they're overlooked now. I think, you know, you alluded to this, the biggest need that was overlooked was our education. There were a lot of children in that camp. I have a picture of all of the children gathered together. We had nothing to do. And a lot of us, we were studious little kids before. You know, we would spend a year, maybe two, in that camp without school. So the thing about saving lunches was that my mother decided we couldn't fall behind. You know, she didn't want us to fall behind academically and she wanted us to learn English. So she went and found a local group of homeschoolers, American homeschoolers, who were in a church in Rome about an hour, hour and a half away. And she asked if we could study with them. And she also got all of their old used workbooks because it was too late to get new workbooks. And she sat erasing so much that she wouldn't even allow a little bit of a shadow of the old answers to come through because that would be cheating and we wouldn't learn. She spent just days and weeks, all day long, going through eraser after eraser after eraser. And we worked through these books. But what that meant was we were away during the day when they served lunch. And we didn't have money to just buy lunch there. So there was an old Afghan woman who had become our friend. And she would save our lunches and we would eat them for dinner. And then we would take our dinners and we would pack them into sandwiches and we would hang them up outside of our room in the cold because there was also no fridge. And then we would take those on the bus to Rome the next day.
It sounds, it's an extraordinary upbringing from which you were finally, I want to say the word rescued. I don't know if that really is the right word.
Yeah, that's how it felt for us.
And went off to Oklahoma. How did that happen?
Well, you go, I suppose, through the asylum process. You know, all of the people at Hotel Barba were petitioning various countries for asylum. So they were doing interviews with various, embassies and immigration offices. And we interviewed, at the American embassy. And we were asked a number of questions. My brother and I were questioned alone about to see if we were raised in the religion that we said, we were raised in. We knew all of the Bible stories. My mother was, of course, someone very credible. And in those days, they didn't question Christians from Iran as they do now. And so it felt very much like someone plucked us out of there and, opened the door to this wonderful place and took us in.
Mm. Now, when you get to Oklahoma, of course, the story changes and you become, indeed, you have always been this very studious girl, but suddenly you have a focus because you realize that what you really want to do is go to Harvard. Tell us about that.
Well, I think the first realization was this America that I've landed in is not the America of the movies. This is not the America of great opportunity, etc. I mean, my parents had both attended medical school in Tehran University, and in Iran we have this too. I mean, there were the villages and then there was Tehran University where the smart kids went, So that kind of thinking was already very much in my head. And in Oklahoma, I realized, oh, okay, this is the American version of the far-flung villages or I need to be elsewhere if I'm going to find security for myself or build a home. I mean, I was so scared after those 2 years. I had just fallen so far in economic class specifically. I had experienced things, worries that I had never in my life experienced before. So then, of course, at 10, 11, when I arrived in Oklahoma, I became obsessed with security, with getting out of Oklahoma, with becoming someone who didn't ever have to worry about shelter or food or, paying bills or anything like that ever again. So I started to obsess with the notion of getting into Harvard. I thought that was the only place that would give me that. And it was the only name an Iranian father who was left behind would recognize and other Iranians in my family. So I started reading all of these books. Remember, this was the 90s, so there wasn't the internet and, there wasn't so much available information. I read some old books about getting into college and they said you need to be stellar academically, but also have all of these other activities. You should be a star in some way. And, it mentioned that it wouldn't hurt to have a national championship in something. So I thought, how am I going to get a national sports championship? And I told this to my father, who was just, he's like, this is absurd. Dina, why do you want to go to sport college? Go to a good university. And I said, believe it or not, Harvard is, this is the best university. And for some reason, I have to do this. So I went looking and I found Taekwondo, which was a sport where they handed out trophies by belt and weight and gender and age and many competitions all over, that you could travel to. And there were hardly any girls. And I thought, well, this is where I will clean up.
And indeed you did.
I did. I spent a couple of years just getting Taekwondo trophies. And then I did win a national championship, which was just bananas when you think about it. Afterward, I quit, of course, the sport. And these years when I had practiced it, I had become very good. I had become very fit. I had become an athlete. So my coach was just shocked. He said, Dina, where's your passion for the sport? And I said, well, I'm no athlete. This was about Harvard.
And in fact, you didn't get into Harvard.
Not until graduate school. I got into Princeton instead. And of course, my loyalty was changed just immediately, because it was really about being accepted somewhere. But yeah, it was quite a laugh at the time that after all that, it wasn't enough.
So you did your BA at Princeton. You then went on to Harvard mm-hmm. and did an MBA there.
Yes, I did. I did. I got two master's degrees there. And, you know, I remember when I was there, I was actually a live-in advisor for the undergraduates. And it was funny to bring up the memories of wishing for that place and, you know, to be among them, etc. It was very much like Hogwarts, the place that we lived in. But I felt very, very happy with the experience I had had.
Then you went off to the Iowa Writers Workshop, hugely prestigious Iowa Writers Workshop, and did an MFA there.
Yes, I did. You know, sometimes actually I joke about how I need to actually verify that this is still true, but at one point it was that I was the only person ever to have both a Harvard MBA and an Iowa MFA, which shows kind of how ridiculous and stupid I am, unable to choose, because these two, the same sane person doesn't go after both. They're such vastly different things. But I think it's because I was so confused, and all I had was just the desire to do something and to do it well, and I didn't spend enough time thinking about what that would be or why. And I luckily, you know, I mean, I think I was very lucky in that in my second try as a writer, this really was the thing that I was born to be doing. So
you've done a lot of journalism, but you've also written two novels before
yes.
this memoir. Which came first, the journalism or the novel?
The novels. So I was just drawn to fiction very, very early on, even as I was pursuing business and in business school. I come from a tradition of storytellers and people with great imagination, and we told stories all day long in the village where my father grew up with my grandfather and grandmother. And, you know, I think when I started to feel unhappy in the business world and that this wasn't actually for me and maybe security isn't everything, I need to really think about what I want to do, I would go into a cocoon of storytelling, writing little short stories and things that I was absolutely unsure about. I hadn't given myself permission to pursue that yet. So when I finally did give myself permission, I had an offer to come back to a company called McKinsey & Company, which was going to sponsor my MBA. And one day I finally picked up the phone and said, I'm not coming back, which means I then took on a mountain of debt from the business school degree I had just received. And then I just, in that moment, I thought, okay, well, I've just taken on all this debt. Why don't I try to do the thing that I love? Why don't I just try to write some stories? So I wrote fiction for a long time, and it was bad. So bad. And then I started to just throw myself into reading. In that first year when I decided to do fiction writing full time, I think I ordered like 50 used paperbacks from Amazon or somewhere. And, you know, all of the old Booker Prize winners and Pulitzer Prize winners and books that had been iconic somehow in literature, and just read them all day long for months and months and months, and started to develop a craft for myself.
And your first novel then was A Teaspoon of Earth and Sea. That came out in 2013.
Yes. It's interesting. They say the first novel is often autobiographical, but for me, that wasn't until my second novel. My first novel was a fantasy. I think it was a little bit, you know, me indulging in some of the questions that I wasn't willing to face more literally. So the novel was about two sisters, twins, who are born in a, you know, kind of lush Iranian village in the middle of rice fields, the north, near the Caspian. And their father owns a lot of rice fields, and they're comfortable, and the revolution happens. And their mother, just like my mother, is a bit of a rebel, and she gets into trouble, and she runs off with one. And the other one thinks that they've run off to America without her, you know, and what has happened to the sister is revealed at the end. But the entire book then follows the twin that's left behind, the life she lives under the Islamic Republic, and the life that then she fantasizes for her American sister. So it was me fantasizing myself back in Iran, fantasizing myself in America. And it was funny because I had to then write a very kind of comical, very stick figure version of my own life for her fantasies, because obviously she wouldn't have access to the information. And then write a kind of a rich, fantastical version of what I would live in Iran.
And that novel went on to be translated into 14 languages. And then you wrote something a little bit closer to home mm-hmm. in your second book, Refuge.
Yes. Refuge was, you know, it was actually very hard for me to come to my second book. I wrote all of these different manuscripts trying to get at what I should write next. And my editor at the time said, what is the thing that you think about that really just hurts that has happened, I suppose, in the last decade? And I thought about how I had only seen my father four times since the time I was eight. since we left Isfahan, there had been 4 visits in various European countries where he managed to get a visa. And we saw each other for, you know, 10 days at a time. And each time he had aged and my life had changed. Once, you know, I had gotten a degree. Another time I had gotten married. It was just all a shock. And each time the cultural gulf between us had widened even more. So Refuge is a story about a very unhappy young woman in Amsterdam who is in a marriage she shouldn't be in. And she is a workaholic. She's afraid. She's got trauma from her refugee days, and she sees her father 4 times. And it's a story of those 4 visits and how she learns from him, from his very joyful way of living, to get access again to the little girl she left behind.
Now, that was a New York Times editor's choice. And although it's called fiction, it's clearly very close to your
heart. It is very close.
And so your next book, which was an extension of this Guardian long read, The Ungrateful Refugee, has just come out. It is a memoir. You do acknowledge that this is your life. But in it also are stories of other people and other refugees and what their experience has been. And I'm very interested in the title and how that reflects the refugee experience.
Sure. Well, you know, as you mentioned before, the title came from this essay. And the essay was about, first of all, you know, so much had just happened in the world, the vote for Brexit, the election of Trump, and I had had a baby. And suddenly I looked around and the world looked different and I had to bring another human being into this new world. And I was afraid and angry and I had something to say. And the first thing that I thought of, you know, is why are there some people who have to walk around life, go through life, posturing gratitude to other people who had nothing to do with their circumstances. There's one set of people who are born into lucky circumstances and others who are born in war or famine or all kinds of terrible situations. And if they happen to find their way to something similar to the first group, they then have to spend all their energy posturing gratitude, trying to assimilate faster. And it felt to me terribly unfair and a burden that actually refugees and immigrants don't often talk about. They don't want to say it because it feels, again, ungrateful after all that they've been given.
And that's the thing. People are not getting the education they want or the support that they need because it feels like they can't even ask.
Well, I think there's a lot they don't ask for. Specifically, like, for example, take the camps. I visited camps in Greece while I was writing this book. And of course, I had lived in one as a child. Nobody asks, you know, why are we not getting schooling during this time? All they think about is just give me my papers, just give me my papers any day. And then I will make a life for myself in the new country. Whatever we lose during this time, we will work for it and gain it back. Everybody just thinks that they are always asking for too much. And so they keep their focus on the one thing, which is to be accepted, to get those papers, and then they lose precious many other things, dignity, their profession, their identity, and again, the children's education, which with enough time passing, it's not as if you just lose the 4th grade or the 5th grade, you lose the habit of study. You know, you lose discipline, you become a different sort of child if you wait too long. So, yeah, and I think that even after many refugees and migrants arrive into their destination, they don't share everything that's missing with their native-born neighbors. It feels as though the miracle of rescue is too much to look away from. It's too bright an event, I suppose. You have to keep your eye on it and always be thankful and bowing.
Now, you came across one project that was happening in camps in Greece, which just was helping to normalize the refugee experience.
Well, I think something a little bit different. I think they were trying to bring some normality to that waiting time. But certainly they didn't want to make that a permanent thing or a permanent moment in their lives. But the organization was called Refugee Support. And it began when the 2 founders, Paul and John, met in Calais. They were both volunteers, businessmen, and they saw that in Calais, the volunteers were giving the donated food and clothing from the back of trucks, often tossing them out while lines of people formed. It was just a way of giving charity without any dignity. And people would then have to barter for what they needed. And, you know, there would be fights and things would be trampled. It was terrible. Nobody was happy in that situation. So they decided to start, you know, stores, set up stores inside refugee camps where the donated food and clothing could be distributed using points as money. Because everybody knows what it's like to shop at your neighborhood store. And there's the dignity of being able to choose the items that you will get.
And that absolutely gives something back to people. It makes them feel like they have a choice.
Exactly. And I think choice is so, so vital. It takes something away from you to be given a package with half the things that you don't eat and some things that you're allergic to, and then have to go and knock on the neighbor's shipping crate and say, hey, coffee for some tea. I mean, that's really a kind of abjection. And these people are people with respect and dignity at home. So it's nice to take your 100 points and go to the camp store and say, you know, I'm going to take sunflower oil instead of olive oil, or I'm going to, you know, have, I don't know, a jar of chocolate spread. They have the choice to spend all their points on garbage if they want to. They don't. You know, no one has to police what they eat.
Yeah. Dina, finally, you asked the question in the book, am I still a refugee after decades spent transforming? Are you?
You know, that's a really tough question, because I am very aware of the privileges I have had after I arrived in Oklahoma. You know, after I was in, you know, an open, relatively welcoming space where I could study, where I could, you know, do my sport, where I could have a future. And since then, I've had a really, you know, wonderful life. So it's hard to call myself by the same label as some of the people that I've seen still suffering, still in limbo, who will actually have a really long, tough psychological road ahead of them. But I actually think it's important to call myself what I am, because I was a refugee, and I did go through that, and it shaped me. And I think I can be an example of what can happen 30 years down the line. I think perhaps people on both sides of the debate need to see that. But also, I think refugees themselves need to understand that the hardest part, the most terribly undignified part, the part where you just want to, you know, huddle in a corner, that will be over. Life is a long, long, long road. And this label can be worn with pride by someone. And so that's how I try to look at it. So yes, I call myself a refugee, and it's a part of my story that I'm not ashamed of.
Dina Ayeri, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you for having me.
The Ungrateful Refugee by Dina Ayeri is published by Canongate. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of Jack Jewers and Nora Hall. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.